call this meeting of Senate Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. on Monday, February 8th, 2021. Please let the record also reflect that we have a quorum present today. Our Vice Chair, Peter Michicki, Senator Bishop, Senator Stevens, and myself, Chairman Rivak, and we have Senator Kawasaki online from Fairbanks, from the LIO. I'd like to also... we also have Senator Keel present. Thank you. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Staffing today's meeting is my committee aide, Ms. Betty Tangeman. Our LIO moderator is Alex Banizak, and our record secretary is Chris Dickrell, who is with us online. Today we're going to hear about ANILCA from an ANILCA training expert, Ms. Tina Cunning, who has done many prior trainings for the legislature and has many, many years of experience in this area. So we're very excited to hear from her, and I appreciate her willingness to conduct this training on such short notice. Due to time constraints and the nature of the presentation, it is pretty detailed information. I would ask that you please hold your questions until an appropriate time. I'm sure Ms. Cunning will take breaks for questions. I would ask that if you're listening, Ms. Cunning, please take breaks periodically for questions, but as much as you can, hold your questions until the end so that we can get through as much of this presentation as possible. So with that, let's get started. Ms. Cunning, if you could please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Senator Rivak. I just want to make one correction. This is not a training. This is going to be an overview. I participate with a number of other people in conducting ANILCA trainings, and the very most minimum that we do is 2 full days. We have done some shortened sessions for the legislature in the past, and we would welcome the opportunity to come back. So I'm going to give you an overview. I do work as an ANILCA consultant. I retired 11 years ago, serving as the ANILCA program manager for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So for the presentation outline, I'm going to go through a little bit of the history leading into ANILCA. You had a presentation Wednesday by Dick Milius. He gave you the background leading up to ANILCA of land and water issues in the state. So I'm going to give you a little bit of the background of all of the deal making that went on in crafting ANILCA, which was passed in 1980. Then an introduction to the act, just covering the from the very highest level the key parts of the act, and then a few select key provisions that I know some of you are interested in. I've heard you bring them up in some other presentations. I'll identify a couple of the many amendments that have been passed to ANILCA, and then where we are in terms of the mechanics of implementation today, 40 years later. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, yes, and thank you for that clarification. We're excited to receive the overview.
Okay, so the next slide in the packet, the third slide, is one of Dick's slides, where he described the background, what was going on at the time the ANILCA legislation came up. There was a wave in Congress of environmental awareness and a lot of bipartisan work among delegations to pass these landmark legislations. And passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act reflects this same awareness in its Section 17, D1 and D2, and 17A. Next slide. In ANCSA, the Native Claims Settlement Act, Section 17A1, Congress established the Joint Federal State Land Use Planning Commission. This had involvement by the state and federal agencies and the most recently formed ANCSA Corporation representatives who were finally achieving their goal of major land claim settlement. And you'll recall from Dick's presentation that the Secretary of Interior had frozen state land selections a few years earlier while seeking settlement of the native land claims. Next slide. So while passage of ANCSA was intended to free up lands for selections, ANCSA also withdrew lands from selection. In 17D1, the Secretary was authorized to withdraw lands from all forms of mineral entry leasing for study and classification. And those withdrawals, the D1 withdrawals, do not expire and can be reclassified and revoked by the Secretary at any time. But ANCSA Section 17D2 directed the Secretary to withdraw up to 80 million acres from state and ANCSA selections and other activities to study for Congress to designate conservation system units. They established a seven-year deadline by 1978 for the withdrawals to expire. So just 12 years after statehood, and at the same time as the Native organizations were just winning their legislation to allow land selections, both were frozen out of selections out of large areas while this process of study by the Joint Federal State Land Use Commission and lobbying by various delegations occurred towards passage of what became ANILCA. And everyone that had been involved, next slide, everyone that had been involved in passage of ANCSA now pivoted to working on reaching a conclusion to the 17D2 provisions. The environmental community in Alaska and nationally had been very successful in those previous years in getting legislation like NEPA and EPA passed, and they viewed Alaska as the last major wilderness. They wanted as much acreage as possible. And remember during this time period that there was no internet? So meetings, newsletters, teleconferences were the source of information. Alaskans, who were greatly concerned, having just achieved statehood recently, that these large withdrawals were going to restrict their way of life, their economic and social future. And the interests like the timber industry, mining, the ANCSA corporations, all were worried about the impacts of these areas on access to develop their own lands and have a future, economic future that they thought they were promised. So the governor's office established a D.C. office to assist Congress. There were staff from the state and the ANCSA corporations who were present to provide information on access, key areas where industry was were located. The Citizens for the Management of Alaska Lands formed to help lobby back in Congress. And many, many others were involved in participating in the hearings, testimony, and providing information to Congress. Next page.
Is it an appropriate time to ask questions? We have a question from Senator Stevens.
Just asking you to, if you wouldn't mind, to let us know who was the governor, who were our congressional delegation at this time.
During this time period, we had Governor Hammond, and our delegation was Senator Gravel, Senator Stevens, and Congressman Young.
Thank you very much. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay. So in 1974, and this is, remember, 1971 with ANCSA, in 1974, Secretary Morton, Department of Interior Secretary, introduced the first bill. I've seen the bill. It's 40 pages long, and it is pretty short, specific to addressing creating of the conservation system units. And from 1974 to 1977, most of the bills stayed within that approximate range that had been set up under 17D2 to withdraw up to 80 million acres for study. But in 1971, Congressman Udall introduced H.R. 39, which significantly changed the game. Instead of up to 80 million acres, his bill proposed 115 million acres of new conservation system units, and 145 million acres of what we term instant wilderness. And that would have been all the new conservation units and all the existing units in Alaska, including the Tongass Forest, would be instantly wilderness. That changed the approach everyone was taking towards the D2 bill, and that's what people called it in the 70s, was D2. So from 1977 to 1978, Alaska's delegation changed its focus from trying to get the land withdrawals to be smaller to focusing on protecting the public uses that were so important for Alaskans and Alaska's future. In 1978, the bill that reached the floor, Senator Gravel filibustered it, so Congress adjourned without having passed legislation in the fall of 78. Remember that the D2 legislation in ANCSA required that the withdrawals expire in 1978. So you can go to that next slide. So with Congress going home without having passed a bill in November of 78, Secretary Andrus withdrew 110 million acres through authorization under the Federal Land Policy Management Act. And in December, President Carter converted 56 million of those 110 million acres into 17 national monuments under the Antiquities Act. The monuments, for Alaskans, no one knew exactly what was allowed and wasn't. There were rangers approaching trappers in the field, telling them they couldn't trap there. There were local residents who were told they couldn't use snow machines. I lived in Glen Allen at the time. There was a protest of over 100 women in Glen Allen that marched between the post office and BLM with signs saying, "Don't lock us out." The Carter monuments resulted in Alaskans and the Alaska delegation focusing even more firmly on the uses that were going to be needed of those federal lands, while the Alaska Coalition, environmental groups, increased their lobbying for more land in the CSUs. Early in 1979, the governor put together an advisory team of ANCSA representatives, industry, even Alaska conservationists, to come up with some consensus points about what they needed in the final legislation. They worked with the legislature and came up with the first 6 points that are on this next slide, the 7 consensus points. The first 6 were worked out by Governor Hammond. And when it went through for the legislature's approval, the legislature added the 7th, the so-called no more clause, insisting that there be no more large withdrawals of federal lands from general public uses in Alaska. So in 1979, the delegation actively lobbied for these points in their hearings and debates back in Congress. So next slide. From 1979 to 1980, there were more markups, hearings, negotiations, a lot of deal cutting that there isn't always a good record of in the legislative history. So in August of 1980, the Senate passed H.R. 39. It's a little bit confusing if you work through the legislative history of ANILCA because they would put H.R. 39 up and then substitute out with a totally new bill in it, but everybody wanted H.R. 39 to be the name of their bill. H.R. 39 passed in August of 1980 by the Senate was similar in size to the 1978 House bill that had failed. But there were more protections for Alaskans, such as the traditional access and provisions for traditional activities on the federal lands. Then in November, President Carter lost the election. With the remaining 3 weeks of a lame duck Congress, House passed the Senate version very quietly on November 21st of 1980. Staff discovered just a couple things that were missing, not clear in both the House and Senate versions, and those were fixed with concurrent resolutions adopted by both December 1 of 1980, and President Carter signed ANILCA on December 2. This was dubbed the Great Compromise. And at this signing, Carter said, "Now Alaskans can get on with their land selections and their lives." And some have asked why Senator Stevens didn't vote against passage. In those days, Congress was pretty respectful if it was single state legislation and the delegation was opposed that they wouldn't move it forward. So they asked why Stevens went ahead with it. And his response at that time was, if it hadn't passed, with all these comprehensive compromises protecting Alaska's public uses built into it, that the balancing would not have been enshrined. It would not have endured. It would have left battles for the future of those Alaska lands and the uses of those lands for subsequent Congresses. So that's the deal-making that led up to ANILCA. So I'm going to move into the introduction to the Act itself. If you want to switch to the slide that has the breakdown of ANILCA at the top in its components, most people view ANILCA as lands legislation that set aside large swaths of general BLM and Forest Service public use lands into CSUs. This slide shows the breakdown of ANILCA by pages and percentages. And approximately 25% of the bill is the establishment of the conservation system units and special areas. But 30% of the bill balances those designations with specific provisions for protecting public uses and traditional activities. 42% amends ANCSA and the Statehood Act. So within 9 years of passage of ANCSA, problems that had cropped up in that first set stage of implementing ANCSA were resolved with some of these amendments that are in the bill. And as you see, it's 42% of the bill with those amendments. So next slide. This is how we group ANILCA's organization when we're doing actual training. There are 15 titles in ANILCA, but you can group them into four major parts. The introductory material, which is the definitions, the purposes of the act, et cetera, applies to most of the act. And so it's fundamental to understanding that section in order to understand much of the rest of the act. The second grouping, which is the establishment and expansion of the conservation system units in areas, titles 2 through 7, are the ones that create the parks and refuges, expanded existing parks and refuges, created the special BLM areas, et cetera. The third grouping are the special Alaska provisions, which we talked about. And the fourth grouping are the amendments to the Native Claims Settlement Act and the Alaska Statehood Act. So with that, I'm going to switch to the next slide, and we're going to talk about Title I. Title I established Congress's intent in passage of the Act. They wanted to preserve these unique areas. They wanted to preserve certain values and uses. These are all spelled out in Title I. They wanted to provide the opportunity for rural residents to continue their subsistence way of life, and explicitly did not want any more land set aside through the Antiquities Act, that this represented a proper balance of uses and conservation. The definitions are very important, and as many years as I worked in ANILCA, I found myself having to always go back and look at the definitions. Two of the definitions really stand out for the public to understand, and one is the definition of public land. The Act defines land as being land, waters, and interests therein. It defines federal land as land in which the title is in the federal government, and public land as federal land with some provisions related to the status of the selections by the state and the native corporations. And since those selections are almost all in the tentatively approved or IC process now, the distinction between federal lands and public lands is very minor, so it's almost interchangeable. The definition of conservation system unit, this refers to the parks, refuges, wild and scenic rivers, the national trails, the wilderness areas. It does not include the two BLM special areas, in the Steese and White Mountains National Conservation and Recreation Areas, and we'll come back to that later. It's important to always go back to that definition of conservation system unit because it doesn't include the study areas that were designated for wilderness. It doesn't include a number of the other designations. So when we're looking through at specific provisions in ANILCA, we look to see where it applies. Does it apply on the public lands? Does it apply on the conservation system units? That's real important when you're looking at each provision of ANILCA. The third section of this Title I is what they call the MAPS section. And what that's referring to is that they had all these committee meetings and markup sessions where they were basically using grease pencils to draw lines. The final MAPS that accompany the passage of ANILCA are what control the acreage of the new units. So those MAPS were put under lock and key and off to the archives somewhere. And luckily, the State Department of Natural Resources had the foresight to go with the armed security guards and get photographs of those maps at the time before they went into archives. And those photographs of the maps showing exactly where those boundaries were at that time are available on DNR's website. One of the important parts of the 103 is that the new areas that were added to Glacier Bay, Katmai, many of the other units that are in the coastal areas, their boundaries do not extend seaward beyond mean high tide to take in this state's tidelands and submerged lands. Sometimes you'll see the maps have a line out in the water for those new areas, but the legal boundary description ends at mean high tide. One of the significant parts of this section is that Congress authorized the agencies to do minor boundary adjustments and land exchanges without going back to Congress for approval. Part of the reason for that was the extensiveness of these areas. They knew they might have missed some element. If you designate a little portion of an area wilderness that has, you know, a railroad hub in it, it doesn't qualify. And so the agency could adjust the boundaries to where necessary. And the third part of this section is 103C, which has been in court, some of you have heard of. And this is the section that says only federal land within the CSU boundaries are public lands. The state and private lands that are acquired by the U.S. that are within those boundaries can become part of the CSU, but the Conservation System Unit regulations only apply to the federally owned lands and waters within that. This was an extremely important point for both the INCSA corporations and the state in the passage of ANILCA. And this issue was the key focus of the Sturgeon lawsuit, which you are all heard of and which decided a couple years ago. So with that, I'm going to move to the next slide, which is the organization slide again.
We have a quick question from Senator Machicki.
Thank you, and thank you, Ms. Cunning, for being here today. So my understanding is that they're all coastal lands between mean high water and down tidal zone is state land. Is that correct?
It is correct, except where there may have been pre-statehood withdrawals. And Dick went through that with you a little bit on Wednesday. So, for example, the Glacier Bay, which actually has been to court, the boundary for the original Glacier Bay unit does extend seaward. But where ANILCA added land northward up towards the Yakutat area, the boundary ends at mean high tide. There are some units, for example, out on the Alaska Peninsula, where the grease pencils are a little bit offshore. A number of years ago, Department of Interior published some corrections to their maps, noting that the boundaries of the units were, those were new units, were intended to end at mean high tide. But not all of the mapping that's put out has been corrected.
Okay, brief follow-up.
Yes.
So the Sturgeon case was about navigable waters. Is that correct? Does the... It doesn't require tidal influence to be state navigable. Is that correct as well?
Yeah, it's two different issues. The Sturgeon case, rather than getting too in depth into who owns which submerged lands, the Sturgeon decision by the Supreme Court was very clear that the regulations for the management of those conservation system units applies only to the federally owned lands.
Is that
yeah, that's fine for now. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you would like to have us do a session for you on ownership and management, we can do that someday.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can actually ask the questions offline. I'm particularly interested in that particular part of ANILCA because I think that's where we've had the greatest struggle on state management on submerged lands. So I'm very curious. So I can do that offline. Thank you.
Thank you. Please, Ms. Cunning, continue.
Okay, so we're going to the second grouping, this establishment of the conservation system units, and if Betty will switch to the first slide there, which is Title II National Park System. It's really odd doing a presentation and not knowing what slides you're seeing. So we work through this. So the parts Titles 2 through 7 create the conservation system units and special areas. And this first one, Title 2, is the National Park System. And under Title 2, Congress established 10 new national parks in Alaska. It expanded 3 of the existing units and didn't touch or address 2 of the units. That's the Sitka and Klondike. For the 15 units that ANILCA specifically addressed, it established independent purposes for each of those units. They're different for each of those park units. And it established that acreage that we just talked about from Title I. It established some key directions for administration of the park and preserve units. And there's some additional directions for administrations of the park and preserves in Title 13. Title 13 applies to many of the CSUs and all and much of the federal lands, and it's not referenced in each of these CSU titles for each of these units. So one not only looks at the title for, in this case, park system to Title II, but you also have to check for the provisions that are in the other titles, and particularly Title 13, to see what might be specific and be applied to the park units. That makes it a little bit confusing, that's why we put it on each slide so that people remember to double check. One of the significant things that the park system was required to do, which was pretty new, it had been required 2 years earlier in Redwood management plans, but here it were required for all the management plans for all the park units. And this was supposed to lay out what was allowed, what were the existing conditions, the access and future access needs. And Congress said that these management plans are to be developed in consultation with the public, the corporations, other adjacent land managers, and the state of Alaska. And all subsequent revisions to those management plans are to have the same degree of consultation. This is very important, as this is where the direction for the management of these units gets set. There are a number of other provisions that are on your slide. I'm not going to mention there. The units, each unit has its different purposes and uses that are laid out. In Title II is where Congress made its determination that Ambler Road was to be authorized. They actually made a public interest finding after much debate, like many other things in ANILCA. So going to the next slide, Title III, the National Wildlife Refuge System. Congress established 9 new national wildlife refuges, modified 7 of the existing refuges, and again, for each of those 16 national wildlife refuges, it established statutory purposes of those units, the acreage, and a number of individual provisions for uses on individual refuges. Congress required management plans and revisions to be done in consultation with the public and the landowners and the state and the Native corporations. They were supposed to specify the uses that were considered compatible with the statutory purposes. This is something that's unique to the refuge system. Just like with the park system, they had provisions for upland support of commercial fishing. In 1997, Congressman Young was one of the primary authors of the Refuge Improvement Act, which established some additional administrative directions for the refuge system. We have to meld those with the administrative provisions that are in ANILCA. But the very last section of the Refuge Improvement Act says if there's any conflict between that act and ANILCA, ANILCA prevails. And I certainly wish that our delegation would always keep in mind that when there's legislation that comes along that could potentially conflict with ANILCA, that they would include that kind of a savings clause. It would be really helpful. Moving to the next slide, Title IV, the National Conservation and National Recreation Areas. Realize that BLM was losing vast amount of its acreage. That was in Dick's slides showed the acreage that was moving out of general BLM land management to these other agencies for conservation system unit And Congress decided to establish these two special areas, the Steese and White Mountains. These are up in the Fairbanks area. These are not conservation system units. They are areas. So when we're looking at public uses in other parts of ANILCA and where they apply, we have to be very careful to be sure that if it says CSUs, we look to see if it says areas also. There's just special provisions there for Steese and White Mountains related to allowing mining and other activities in those areas. Switching to Title V, the National Forest System. Congress expanded the Chugach and the Tongass, pretty expansively expanded it. And they withdrew parts of the Chugach from the mining laws. They created two special areas in the Copper River area. And then the Tongass, which was a hard-fought struggle leading up to its passage, they established two national monuments, Misty Fjords and Admiralty Island Monuments. And out of those, they carved some specific provisions for unperfected mining claims and to allow, for example, the Greens Creek mining operation. There are a number of provisions for land exchanges with the land ownership on the Admiralty was fairly complicated. Let's see, we're going to come back to the forest in just a minute. Let's move on to Title VI, the National Wild and Scenic River System. Congress designated 25 wild and scenic rivers as wild or scenic or recreational. Sometimes you'll see people refer to 26 wild and scenic rivers. There's actually only 25, but because a portion of the Lagnac is within the national park was designated and a portion of it that's not in a park that was in BLM lands was also designated, it gets listed twice in the act, but it's really only the same river. So there's 25 designations.
Could you please, 12 study rivers. Could you please repeat the name of the river?
The 12 study rivers?
The Lagnac.
One of them was recommended for designation. That was the Sheenjek. And another one that was initially recommended after ANILCA passed, after the studies were completed, was the Setuck. But after the Setuck was recommended to the secretary to be on the list to be designated, the community in the Yakutat area became quite concerned. That's kind of their breadbasket with the fisheries and timber. They ended up developing a four-party agreement signed by the regional forester, the governor of Alaska, and Yakutat Kwan, and the borough city of Yakutat, and asked that that be a cooperative agreement for the corridor, so all parties would be working together on the management of that corridor instead of it being designated as a wild and scenic river. And the secretary agreed to that and officially withdrew that recommendation. So a real interesting history on that one.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
I'm sorry. You said there were 25 to 26 wild and scenic rivers, and you said the problem was that there were two of the same river, and I missed the name of that river and where it
that's
is.
That's the Alagnac. It flows out of Nonvinnik Lake in Katmai.
Thank you.
A-L-A-G-N-A-K. The Alagnac River is designated within the park and separately designated outside of the park in BLM land.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cunning. Please continue.
So Title VI expressly amends the Wild and Scenic River Act. And this is really important in Alaska because you notice one of the river that's shown there is the Gulkana Wild and Scenic River. The Gulkana Wild and Scenic River has a pipeline that crosses it and roads. The Congress clearly stated that when establishing the boundaries of these wild and scenic rivers, these 25, that those boundaries only include the federal land within those boundaries. The statute lays out a number of administrative provisions, like such as management planning, and that there could be no mining within a half mile of the wild river designated, and no mining state selections or appropriations on the federal lands that are within 2 miles of the rivers while the studies were ongoing. And a number of other amendments to the Wild and Scenic River Act that are pretty important. But that piece about it only applying to the federal land is pretty important to Alaskans. You look at the Gulkana River, a third of the uplands of the Gulkana-Wild and Scenic River Corridor is owned by Aetna. A third is owned by the state, and a third is owned by BLM, and the state owns the bed of the river. So that's why Congress decided to make that very clear. Moving on to the next slide, Title VII. This is the National Wilderness System. Congress designated 8 wilderness areas that overlay national park units, and their boundaries do not necessarily follow the same boundaries as the park boundaries. There are 13 wilderness areas in the refuges, 14 in the Tongass National Forest. They designated a wilderness study area in the Chugach. This is the Nelly Wan. The Chugach Management Plan was just out again for another revision, and that study area is sometimes in the paper related to its recommendations for designation of that study area. The interesting provision that was part of the Balancing Act of ANILCA in designating those 14 wilderness areas in the Tongass at that time, Congress also mandated that the Secretary make 4.5 million board feet of timber available each year. It's actually in the statute as 4.5 billion board feet per decade in the Tongass for harvest. So while carving out big chunks of the Tongass for wilderness designation and the two monuments, it also wanted to protect the harvest of timber in the remainders of the Tongass. It also prohibited the Secretary from conducting further statewide roadless review in Alaska. And there are a number of other provisions related to the administration of these units. And I want to go to the next page now. This page is some of the special provisions that apply to wilderness in Alaska. We're not into that section of my presentation, but I just want to show how this works. These are all the methods of access and activities and facilities that Alaskans were so concerned about being able to do their traditional harvests, their traditional activities. When you take all the various pieces that are in ANILCA that apply on wilderness designated lands, this is a primary sampling of them. New and existing cabins, facilities for research, access to inholdings, and even the ability to develop transportation and utility systems across those areas. There's a specific process we'll talk about in the next section. So while 25% of the federal lands in Alaska are designated wilderness by ANILCA, many traditional existing activities, access and uses of the federal lands, Congress directed shall be allowed. Now that's not to say it's a free-for-all. There are regulations that have gone through the process and been adopted to regulate those activities, but those are activities that normally would not have been allowed in wilderness areas. So now switch to the next slide. This is my ANILCA's organizational slide. These special provisions for uses of the federal lands in Alaska is approximately 30% of ANILCA. It's many different provisions, and we're going to start off with the next slide, Title 8. This is the subsistence management and use title. Title 8 is unique. There are only a couple other titles of the Act that have where Congress made individual findings, laid out what their policy intent was for management, and specific definitions that apply to this title. The intent of Title 8 was to provide a preference for the opportunity for customary and traditional subsistence use, among other consumptive uses, by a rural residents on the federal land. It lays out a number of important pieces related to local and regional participation in the regulatory process. It authorizes the secretaries to regulate harvests, and it directs the secretaries to conduct monitoring of the subsistence priority. Congress made it permissive for the state to administer this section. This is the first part of Title 8, and it granted unique provisions related to coordination between the state and the federal government. But it's not all about subsistence harvest. Title VIII is a complicated title. It has a very important provision in it in 810 that requires that all federal land management decisions and actually other decisions also be evaluated for their impacts on subsistence. So that's a process the federal agencies go through whenever they're doing their management planning and making other decisions. And one of the significant parts of Title VIII that was very important to all Alaskans was 811, which it says the secretary shall permit the traditional methods of access for subsistence uses. And this is not traditional subsistence uses. This is traditional methods of access. And so there's special rulemaking for that, how that's defined, how that's applied, and when it can be closed. We're going to come back to some of these. I guess we're just rolling through the titles here. So next one, Title 10. This one is all North Slope. This is was set up the studies of the lands on the North Slope, the establishment of the 1001, 1002, 1003 areas, the prohibition on oil and gas development in the Arctic Refuge, a number of provisions related to research, and some important provisions related to oil and gas leasing in the non-wilderness portions. All those studies, by the way, were done back in the 80s, and this section of ANILCA has been amended several times, so we're going to talk about amendments a little bit later. This is what's in ANILCA itself. Moving on to Title 11.
If we could pause there for just a second, I'd like the record. Please let the record reflect that Senator Von Imhoff is with us, and we have a question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At the risk of going down a rabbit hole, is there a short description of the difference between a wilderness study and a wilderness review?
Wilderness study and wilderness review are essentially the same thing. The agencies review their lands for wilderness characteristics when they're doing various management planning. The Nelly Wan study area was specifically set aside as a study area. So there are some provisions of ANILCA that are different for wilderness study areas, and that would not include areas that are just being reviewed for possible wilderness characteristics under the general management planning process. I'm sure that's clear as mud.
Yep, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Please continue.
Title 11. This was a huge part of the lobbying effort by the state and the Native corporations and the various interests in Alaska during the passage of ANILCA. There was, when you look at a map of the state and the establishment of the conservation system units, you can't hardly get there from here without crossing a conservation system unit. And Congress debated this extensively, and they tried to determine whether to set aside corridors across these units for future transportation needs and utilities, or what they ended up actually doing was establishing a unique process for applications for transportation and utility system rights of way across these conservation system units, including wilderness areas. It's a unique process, doesn't exist anywhere else in the United States in conservation units. There have been a lot of myths about the TUS process. We find people even in Federal Highway Administration who don't think the transportation utility system process actually works, which is just simply not true. When we do our training, we spend about 2 hours on some of these access provisions and go through how they work. There are two decision processes under this section. One in which an agency has authority to grant rights of way, and then a decision process for those agencies who don't have authority to grant a right of way or it's within wilderness. There's specific criteria and processes for how to handle the applications, how NEPA fits into it, the agency's standards, how they fit into the approval or disapproval process. There's a determination of a lead agency. If a TUS application is disapproved, there is an appeal process to the president and congressional action set up. So the TUS process was really, really important because that would be the only way you could get between communities in the future or get utilities, corridors, water lines between communities or to existing infrastructure. The other provision that's listed there is 1109. This is a real simple section that just said anyone who had a valid existing right prior to the passage of ANILCA, the act does not disturb that valid existing right. It continues. And next page, this is more of the transportation utility system. Two provisions on this slide, which were part of that balancing act for ANILCA. This is 1110A and 1110B. 1110A permits the use of snow machines, motorboats, and airplanes surface transportation for traditional activities. This is non-motorized surface transportation for traditional activities. And the regulations that were adopted in 1986 to implement this section are very true to the provisions of 1110A. They're 43 CFR Part 36 regulations. They have a lot of great language in the preamble and response to comments. Anyone who's dealing with access issues on these areas, I would encourage them either look those regulations up and find the response to comments, 43 CFR Part 36, or contact one of us that are among the ANILCA trainers, and we'll get that language for you. Essentially, what Congress said is the federal lands are open to these activities and methods of access until they're closed under a set of criteria and a process that involves hearings and a finding of damage. And it was very important to include locals in this decision-making. 1110B, the other piece of this, very unique, doesn't occur anywhere else, is language that guarantees the state and private landowners adequate and feasible access for economic and other purposes. And we're going to come back to that. Next slide, Title 12. This is a unique title in federal land legislation in that it sets up an expectation of federal-state cooperation. Based on the recommendations of the Joint Federal-State Land Use Planning Commission, ANILCA established a Alaska Land Use Council. And we're going to come back to this and how it worked. It sunset after 20 years, but it's on the books and it can be renewed. Title 13, this is a catch-all of many administrative provisions. This authorizes the federal agencies to acquire land within the CSUs. It grandfathered in cabins and other facilities and sites of occupancy on the CSUs and the two BLM areas and Forest Service lands. If you were around in the 70s, you'll remember the book Coming Into the Country. It was very popular. Almost all of the delegations back in D.C. had read Coming Into the Country. And they were keen on protecting that traditional lifestyle that involved using structures so that people could continue their way of life on the federal lands. I'm not going to go through all of those. That's just a sampling of the many of the unique provisions that were in there. One of the things that's really important in today's day and age is that it allowed for navigation aids and other facilities to be established on these CSUs. It also rescinded the 1978 to 1980 public land orders. These were the D2 withdrawals and monuments. Next slide is Title 15. This title has never been used, but because people were so concerned about the size of these units might make it very difficult to extract rare elements for mining, this is a process whereby the president can make a recommendation to open an area for those rare minerals. It cannot be used in the Arctic Refuge or in the National Park units, but it can be in the other conservation system units. And there's a whole process laid out for expedited congressional review and rulemaking to make this need. So next slide. This is the fourth section in ANILCA's organization. This is the amendments to the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and the Alaska Statehood Act. These are Titles 9 and Titles 14. This was almost half of the act were these amendments. And remember, the statehood has pretty recent, just over a decade, and the Native Claims Settlement Act had only been passed 9 years before. So there were already parts of implementation of both the Statehood Act and the Native Claims Settlement Act that needed some fixes, and those are in those sections of ANILCA. So moving to the next slide, Title 9, implementation of the Native Claims Settlement Act and the Statehood Act. There's many amendments in this section. Dick went through some of those with you. One of the important things for the state here was that once Interior had approved transfer under the TA provision, tentative approval provisions, transfer of land for the state under the state selection process, once that had reached that process, it could be treated as though the state actually owned it. Up to that time, it was continuing to be managed by the federal agencies, and there were some conflicts that arose. So this straightened that out. The next slide, Title 14, there are 37 sections in Title 14 that amend the Native Claims Settlement Act and have some other related provisions. This one of the key things was fire protection was of great concern to the ANCSA corporations, and there's a provision there that the Federal Wildland Fire Protection will continue on ANCSA lands. And the other one that I highlight there is this is the corollary to Title IX, in which the interim conveyed lands to the Native corporations were essentially treated the same as if they had ownership. Some of the lands that had been interim conveyed, they wanted to do things with them, and the banks wouldn't loan money on those. They treated it still as though it was federal land because the title wasn't actually transferred until it was surveyed. So this provision of ANILCA established that once they get into the interim conveyance process and they're only waiting for survey, it could be treated as though they hold title. So those are all of the 15 titles of ANILCA in less than 15 minutes, practically. We're going to move now. I'm going to go here to the quote from Justice Kagan in the Sturgeon decision, where Kagan confirmed ANILCA's compromises, where she says ANILCA sought to balance two goals often thought conflicting. And she goes on to say, as you continue reading, you see some tension within the statute. You're not mistaken. It arises from Congress's twofold ambitions. And that was to set aside these large areas for protection, as well as to protect these Alaskan uses. So moving to the next slide, we've emphasized several times that these three acts, the Statehood Act, the ANCSA, and ANILCA, are very interwoven. They tear off of each other. The state's entitlement with the Statehood Act was over 100 million acres. The Native Claims Settlement Act, over 44 million acres entitlement, which will actually be over 46 million acres when it's completed. And you'll see different numbers related to the federal conservation system units, anywhere from 103 to 106, and a lot of that's just based on the technology of how to calculate acreage that's changed over the years. But the implementation of these three acts is still very interconnected. So with that, we're done with the introduction to the act. I want to move into some select key provisions and see how ANILCA stacks up against the governor and legislature's seven consensus points. So where I should be on that slide. So this is the 1979 seven consensus points that were adopted by the governor and the legislature, Governor Hammond and the legislature. We actually spend a lot of time on some of these pieces when we do our actual training. I'm going to move to the next slide. I have three slides that have little bullets that list out what people believe was actually resolved in ANILCA that were among those things that the governor and legislature were lobbying for. So it retained all the ANCSA land entitlements in that were already selected inside the ANILCA units. It approved state selections that were outside of the ANILCA units, but the state gave up some of the selections that were inside some of these units. And in turn, the boundaries of some of the original bills were adjusted to exclude some of the high resource areas necessary for development. There are special provisions for mining. There, as I've already described, there are a number of provisions recognizing traditional activities will continue to occur on federal lands. It authorized the agencies to conduct land exchanges and boundary adjustments. And one of those important ones, the no more large withdrawals without congressional approval. If you go to the next slide, this is a summary slide of what all those no more provisions are that are in ANILCA. There's a statement of general intent in Title I. The administrative prohibitions that the executive branch can't withdraw more than 5,000 acres unless Congress passes a resolution within 1 year if they're wanting to nominate it, and says there'll be no further studies of federal lands for the single purpose of establishing new conservation designations without congressional authorization. And then in Title VII, which you recall was the wilderness title, there'd be no further statewide wilderness area reviews for national forest wilderness designation. The next slide, more of the pieces that accommodated Alaska's interests. The new process for future transportation utility corridors that we've talked about. It provided for the Tongass timber harvest and also the 14 new wilderness areas and two monuments as part of the Balancing Act. It provided for local hire, but just by the way, this is one of the sections of ANILCA that's been amended the most often. The last one on that page guarantees access to inholdings. If you go to the next slide, this slide shows the two sections of ANILCA that guarantee access to inholdings, 1110B, which is for the conservation system units, and 1323, which is Forest Service and BLM lands. There are over 2 million acres of inholdings within the park system, and over 17 million acres of inholdings within the wildlife refuge units. So this access to inholdings is incredibly important. The next page, this is an example of a right-of-way on the Kenai Refuge to provide access for Siri to its subsurface estate. So inholdings are both surface and subsurface, and it's expected over the next few decades that there are going to be many more applications to the agencies for access to these subsurface estates in a lot of the refuges. And the third slide on these interests, fundamentally important to the state, was retaining its state management of fish, wildlife, and water. It's state, part of the Statehood Act.
Could I stop you there, Ms. Cunning, just for a second? We have a question on the previous slide from Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. This is actually really informative. You just made a comment using Siri, looking for right-of-way access, and you said that you expected there will be more requests for access by Native corporations in the future. Can you expand on that? Why do you think that's going to happen, and how do you think the Biden administration is going to respond, or is that a state issue?
This is in statute.
Okay.
Congress in 1110B guaranteed access to the non-federal lands, both surface and subsurface, for their current and future uses, for their economic future. This was an important part of the Balancing Act in ANILCA that both the state and the Native corporations lobbied hard for, because it was of no use to the corporations or to the state to own land that it couldn't develop or use. So Congress set up this guarantee of access. There are rules in how this is approved. There's processes that it goes through to have the most minimum possible impact on those conservation system units. And the only reason I say that there's going to be more applications in the future is many landowners, that are particularly subsurface estate owners, don't know yet what resources they own, just like with oil and gas and mining. So in this case of this example, they're going, needing to have a gravel pad, a road of access, in order to access where they can get to their subsurface estate. And that was worked out through an extensive process to minimize the impacts on the surface, on the refuge, but they are guaranteed access to their lands.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We have one more question from Senator Stevens.
Well, following up on that, Ms. Canning, you say it's sort of guaranteed, so I guess would you expect that any time their access is needed, that, well, maybe tell us what is briefly, what is the process by which those applications are approved? Briefly.
You should attend our training.
I'm ready to give myself a college credit for sitting through this.
Sorry. I'm trying to make it as simple as possible. In this case where there's development involved, it's quite different than someone who's just trying to get an access trail or route to their cabin. The process is entirely different depending upon the magnitude of the inholdings needs. And in the case of one like this, there is a special form that's filled out. There's a lot of meetings that are done. There's applications. There's assessments on alternatives worked out between the party and the agency to try to minimize the impact to the unit while still providing the guarantee of access. Now, they're not guaranteed access if there's adequate and feasible access some other way. Mm-hmm. So just because a person wants to cross a CSU doesn't mean they're going to get that permission if there's another economically feasible alternative.
But in general, if an organization owns the land that it could be profitable to mining or whatever, those applications would be approved.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cunning. Please continue.
So that third slide starts out with retaining state management of fish and wildlife. I was just starting out explaining that was a huge impetus for statehood, was trying to get management of fish and wildlife out of the hands of the Seattle processors and the Washington, D.C. bureaucrats. This was a major effort by the state. The Alaska Native Brotherhood in Southeast Alaska, where I grew up, was very involved in lobbying to get state management, to get statehood and to have state management of fish and wildlife. So given the statehood in 1959, there was a great deal of concern under ANILCA that when it passed that the state not lose any of its authorities for management of fish and wildlife. And there is a section in ANILCA 1314 which confirms that nothing in this act affects the responsibility and authority of the state for the management of fish and wildlife, except as specifically provided in Title VIII. And Title VIII authorizes federal regulation of harvests to assure the subsistence preference for the rural residents on federal lands.
Thank you. We actually have a question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I think Ms. Cunning just started to address it there. I've been in some of my Alaska Native Brotherhood Camp 70 meetings where there's a lot of grumpiness with the state over access to subsistence resources. And, you know, 20 slides ago, you did flag that Title VIII federal authority to regulate. So does ANILCA set up anything? Do we have a structure for squaring those two? State guaranteed state management and yet federal management for subsistence?
First of all, there's a lot of misunderstandings about what the term management means. Management under our state constitution is assuring the sustainability of fish and wildlife populations. And that authority is more than just allocating harvests. It's a significant responsibility to assure the health and sustainability of those populations. So even in cases where Congress has diminished, and Congress can and does diminish state authorities for all 50 states, for example, the Marine Mammal Protection Act took away the state's authority to allocate harvests of marine mammals. But the state still has a responsibility to assure the sustainability, and that is why they still monitor marine mammal populations and work closely with the federal agencies that do allocate harvests to protect populations as they go up and down and work together. The same is true with the Federal Subsistence Program. The Office of Subsistence Management and I, a number of years ago, actually put together it's about an hour overview that explains the relationship between the authority under Title VIII for regulation for the subsistence preference on federal lands and the state's authorities for management of fish and wildlife. It is complicated, and it's sometimes tested when people don't understand the terms of the statute. I'll stop there because it's a very complicated area, and we do have a piece in our training that we do that's specific to it that lays out the differences between the states and the federal authorities. There's a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of myths.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The first information is free.
So we're going to move on in my outline. So ANILCA passed. ANILCA did all these things that they had hoped. Senator Stevens, he made an observation that after ANILCA passed, that Alaska got about 85% of what it wanted in ANILCA, and he intended to go back and get the rest. But I think he got distracted with the Magnuson-Stevens Act. So here we have amendments and implementation. It's been 40 years since passage of ANILCA, and ANILCA has been amended many, many times. So don't believe the myth that people tell you ANILCA can't be amended, because it has been. We've compiled all those amendments. It's in a Word document about 53 pages long. So I'm just going to cover a few of the major amendments to ANILCA. After ANILCA passed in 1980, there were actually 11 laws that amended ANILCA between 1981 and 1988. And then in 1988, it was probably the first major one. This was what's oftentimes referred to as the Alaska Submerged Lands Act, although it actually doesn't have that title. And this section deleted all of Section 901 of ANILCA. And this is in the Amendments to ANCSA section of ANILCA. And this was important because the calculations for acreage of the entitlement for the Native corporations was affected by how the Bureau of Land Management calculated submerged lands. If they included land under waterways that turned out to be navigable and thus state-owned later, after their land entitlement was signed off on, they would not be able to come back and replace those lost lands elsewhere. So this section of ANILCA clarifies how they do the acreage calculations to leave the submerged lands out of those acreage calculations where there's a major waterway. There's a few other changes in there too. Probably the most significant one in the eyes of the people who had been involved in ANILCA's passage was the Tongass Timber Reform Act in 1990. So this is 10 years after passage of ANILCA. Congress removed the provision for the 4.5 billion board feet per decade supply of timber in Section 705. It repealed it. And it created 12 new what are called LUDs. These are special management areas under the Natural Forest Management Act. It created 5 additional wilderness areas, and it modified the long-term contracts and created stream riparian buffers. This was huge because part of that balancing act between the wilderness areas and the timber harvest industry had now been undone. In 2014, another major amendment was the Sea Alaska Land Entitlement, which completed Sea Alaska Corporation's entitlement. It created an additional 8 LUDs in the Tongass and made some other changes. And then in 2017, in the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, Congress amended three sections of ANILCA, and this is the Arctic Refuge changes, which require the Secretary to conduct 2 lease sales in 10 years in the non-wilderness coastal plain and authorizes development of less than 2,000 acres for that.
We have a question from Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Cunning, who led the charge on the repeal of the Tongass Timber Reform Act?
I don't know the answer to that question off the top of my head, and I would be happy to find that out and get that back to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Stevens.
So, along with that, maybe I misunderstand the Tongass Timber Reform Act, but conflict with the no more land set aside? Maybe I misunderstand it, but is there a conflict there?
What Congress giveth, Congress can taketh away. Congress said no more administrative withdrawals, but Congress can make its own withdrawals.
Well.
You can say that about government in general. Government giveth and government taketh away.
Well, these are congressional, you know, Congress, and ANILCA passed by Congress, and then Congress came along 10 years later and changed the terms. And Congress will continue to do that.
Of course, but it does change that no more land set aside, doesn't it? Do I understand that right? The Tongass Timber Reform Act did change the way land was set aside?
It changed the balancing act that had been negotiated in ANILCA. But the no more provisions of ANILCA are still in effect. They were not modified. It's just it changed the balancing that was done in terms of what would be wilderness and what would be in harvest areas on the Tongass.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cunning. We have about 18 minutes left, and so we'll try and rally through these slides, and we'll hold our questions till the very end if you can get through these before 5.
Okay, well, switch to the next slide. What's involved in implementation of ANILCA? And we're just going to hit a couple of these pretty quickly. The next slide is the Alaska Land Use Council. Jay Hammond, having been involved through the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission's processes and the lobbying into ANILCA, he was very supportive of cooperative management, and he believed that if the leadership in Alaska, federal and state agencies, and the native corporations sat down together, they could resolve a lot of these issues eye to eye across the table. The ANCSA corporations were involved. I served as a staff committee member to the Land Use Council. This council was very effective in dealing with issues that came up, trying to keep them out of court. They worked on management plans and regulations, tried to be sure that things were consistent with the intent of ANILCA. A couple of years ago, Senator Murkowski proposed legislation to reauthorize the Land Use Council. The people who are all part of the Land Use Council at the time all wanted to see it reauthorized. Legislation never made it in. And she proposed some legislation a few years ago. I know she's interested in this, but there hasn't been a groundswell to get it reauthorized. Next slide is on the public involvement in ANILCA implementation. At the time ANILCA passed, there was a Land Use Advisors Committee. This was a forum that was set up to provide public input into the Land Use Council's recommendations and decisions related to federal actions. It sunset along with the council. The ANCSA corporations had an organization of their land managers who worked alongside of us in dealing with decisions on federal lands, shared information with the corporations, helped keep everybody informed, and they served as a staff to the Land Use Council Staff Committee. And the third organization was created by the legislature, and this is the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas, the CACFA, as it's often called. It was created to provide an avenue for the public to deal with red tape, to understand how management plans work, to get help getting their cabin permits, et cetera. That organization, the legislature just reauthorized it in 2014. It sunsets in June of this year. It's not been active because of budget cuts that started in 2015 and 2016, but it could be reauthorized. This was a very effective organization. They worked directly with federal agency leaders, and it worked with a delegation. For example, when the Federal Office of Personnel Management decided local hire was out of date and wasn't going to be provisioned in Alaska anymore, they were able to go back and get an amendment to ANILCA that made it clear it still provided a local hire provision. Next slide, the state agency's involvement in ANILCA implementation. In 81, the legislature funded a special budget for it being involved in the implementation of ANILCA. Governor Hammond established a structure to be involved in the Land Use Council and retained his Washington, D.C. office. The state set up an ANILCA team to coordinate state agencies' involvement in management plans. I gave you the web link there to that office, which is still in existence today. And that website has a searchable copy of ANILCA on it. It also has our compilation of amendments, and it has all of the state's correspondence since 2000 accessible, so you can see what the history of the state's involvement has been in those things. The next slide is just a diagram that explains how the ANILCA program coordination worked, how it was set up, and how it has continued to work. It was Governor Hammond was not big on creating new government, so he wanted it assigned within the line agencies where it couldn't get chopped off with a future administration. So in 1981, the coordination function was placed in the Department of Fish and Game, and I actually was the first coordinator in 1981. Then in 1984, it was the coordination function was moved to Governor Sheffield's Division of Governmental Coordination. And since 2003, after Governor Murkowski moved it, it's been in OPUMP in DNR. But its effectiveness is based on the cooperation of all the state agencies participating together in coordinating unified responses, so it's consistent with ANILCA. It requires an understanding of not only ANILCA, but also of the federal land laws and regulations. So next page. The first thing everybody worked on was management plans, those are, and the revisions that came along. I'm going to switch to the next page. What's happening 40 years later is that there isn't the same degree of cooperation and consultation that there used to be in the revisions. That's at least what it's reported to me. I've been retired 11 years. Next page. This shows how these plans have evolved over time. This is pictures of the Arctic plans from 1971, 1988, and 2015. It makes it very difficult for the public and the state and the corporations and the stakeholders out there to keep up with things. The next slide, this is the no more clauses, and this is the example of what happens over time. So even though Congress intended there be no more administrative withdrawals, there are what the what people regard as de facto CSUs created when the agencies make special planning designations to manage areas as though they're designated wilderness when they're not, and to limit activities and permits for commercial services, et cetera, based on those values. It has increasingly created some problems for the public and the commercial operators out there. The next slide, this is a slide with a chart you can't read. The chart is 4 pages long. This was put together by the Citizens Advisory Commission a number of years ago, that shows how the agencies are interpreting the cabin provisions of ANILCA differently from agency to agency. And when this was brought to the delegation's attention, the agencies agreed to try to work together to come up with a better guidance consistent with ANILCA in implementation of cabin policies. And next page, the challenges of ANILCA implementation. As we've lost institutional memory and understanding of ANILCA and a collective knowledge among Alaskans in general, it's become more difficult. The loss of the Land Use Council we still feel today, and the loss of the key negotiators that knew what the deal was that was struck by Congress. We have increasing direction that comes out of Washington, D.C. that does not necessarily reflect an understanding of ANILCA. We have decreased information on what those traditional uses were that in 1980 that Congress was intending to protect. And then the last slide, this is another slide from Kagan. The Act provides sufficient protection for the national interest and at the same time provides adequate opportunity for the satisfaction of the economic and social needs of the state of Alaska and its people. She quoted that in Sturgeon. This is right out of ANILCA. But it's up to all of us to keep those promises that were in the compromises when Congress passed ANILCA. And with that, I'm done.
Thank you, Ms. Cunning. We have a question from Senator Bishop.
Thank you for the presentation. It was awesome. I'd needed about 7 days in a row to get a quarter of it and retain it. But thank you. Well done. But I have one question for you. And you said, did I hear you say you lived in Glen Allen in the 70s?
I did.
Did you know Frank Zimbicki?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. You've been around a while.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Stevens.
Yeah, I agree. This has been fascinating, and I just hope I remember tomorrow all the things I learned today. I wish more Alaskans understood what we have been told here. I really appreciate, as you say, it is up to us to keep the memories here of what was done. But I guess my question is about the No More Land set aside. I understand that there have been some changes, but for the most, and I got to say, it seems remarkable to me that it was the legislature that insisted on the No More Land clause. The Alaska State Legislature did that. Generally, has that been the case? And I wonder what would have happened if that clause was not did not exist. So, I guess my question is, has it been relatively successful? I know it's not been totally successful.
You're asking for my opinion on that. I think that language in ANILCA has prevented any more huge withdrawals from out of the general BLM and Forest Service lands, yes.
Great. Kudos to the Alaska legislature.
Well, to the fact that the statute says that the administration cannot make any more of those large withdrawals, more than 5,000 acres.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, I will just say again, thank you, Ms. Cunning, and to the members of the committee, thank you very much. I know this is really in-depth information. I think it's very, very important to understand what happened, where we're at now, before we... I imagine we're going to have to deal with some issues related to ANILCA, and I think you hit the nail on the head when you said that, you know, we're losing a lot of this memory related to these deals made for regarding our lands, and so I think it's so important that we know this stuff. This slideshow I had intended as a reference so that we can quickly find provisions in ANILCA when we're dealing with issues related to our lands. And also, Ms. Cunning also said that she would be available for follow-up and questions. So thank you again for that. We really appreciate you being here and your expertise and sharing with us about the history of ANILCA. And with no other questions, our next committee meeting will be Wednesday, February 10th, at which point we'll hear SB 61, an act authoring the Commission of Natural Resources to modify a net profit share lease, at the request of the governor. Thank you, everyone, for your time and attention today. This meeting is adjourned at 4:53 p.m.